Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Here it is, Monday. It's a beautiful, beautiful day here in Portland, Oregon. Well, if you like kind of gray, rainy days. It's nice to be back home. Had a great week in New York City last week. But I am back and having a fine time at it. So Bush Company's last Christmas gift to us, toxic toys. Turns out that the Bush administration has left us with one final parting shot. The chemical called phthalates, P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. These are chemicals that in children under 12 produce, they behave like estrogen. And in some cases in boys apparently, or in girls apparently, sometimes they even behave like testosterone, but mostly like estrogen. So they seem to be associated with early onset menstruation in girls and undersized or dysfunctional, shall we say, apparatus in boys. That these particularly during childhood exposure, that these chemicals were supposed to be banned as of February 10th. Which means that they wouldn't be being manufactured right now because they couldn't be on the shelves on February 10th. The Bush administration has decided that, what we really mean is that, or what Congress really said was that they have to be, they can no longer be manufactured until after February 10th. The reality is that none of these chemicals are used in manufacturing in the United States. This is all toys coming from China and other countries. So what do we do about this? You know, what do we do about this parting shot from the Bushies? Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D, is on the line with us. Ayn Rand, of course, the pen name of the woman who wrote Atlas Shrugged and several other books, founded the school of objectivism, the concept, the philosophy of objectivism, which in a whole variety of forms has mutated into libertarianism and modern Grover Norquist conservatism, although the pure holders of the flame of objectivism include Yaron Brook and others at the Ayn Rand Institute, as I said, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, although you're setting me up to defend the Bush administration. I don't know about that.
I'm sorry to do that to you. Here's the... I don't know if question's the right word, but should all of us get engineering licenses and build labs in our living rooms so that we can test toys from China, because you and folks who share your philosophy don't believe in any regulations at all, and the Bush administration is kind of going halfway on that?
Well, look, if something is proven to be a poison, then, it shouldn't be sold in the United States as toys. The question really is, what is the standard of proof and who gets to determine it? But, I'm curious.
So you're in favor of regulations?
I'm in favor of laws that protect us, protect our rights and protect our life. So if somebody's pouring cyanide into my water supply, yes, they should be arrested and put in jail. So to the extent that there's proof that a chemical is causing harm, that's what we have a legal system for. I'm surprised that there are not thousands of lawsuits with regard to this, given the damaging effect.
Well, when a little girl starts menstruating at the age of 9 or 10,
sure,
or when a boy at the age of 16 or 18 or 20 or 30,
but this
when he's
has
married
happened.
And
where
and,
the
and, no, no, let me finish the let me finish the sentence here. 20 or 30 years old is having problems impregnating his wife. And they go to a clinic and they say, your sperm is dysfunctional and your testes are small. It's now decades after the exposure that that child experienced at the age of two or three, chewing on one of these toys with phthalates in it. And like much like smoking, there's not some little flag that pops up on the ovaries or the testes saying, "Hi, I'm the result of the exposure on July 1st, 1993, when this child chewed on this toy that came from this particular store." So it's almost impossible to litigate these kind of things.
That's why we need
regulatory agencies.
But you can litigate it. You can litigate it later. But that's exactly the point. Even the regulators. I mean, you're assuming regulators here have foresight into the future that, of course, they don't have. Regulators don't know what these chemicals are going to do to people. You can't wait 20, 30 years before you approve any chemical for any use. You would stop all progress if you did that.
What you're describing is exactly what they do in Europe. It's called the precautionary principle.
When you discover that a compound has negative effects, You know, it's litigated, and if it's found that the effects are true, that it's objective science, then you ban that substance because that substance is clearly harmful.
We've known that phthalates do this for 20 years.
You can't ban something until their negative effects. The precautionary principle, if applied correctly, would have prevented the entire industrial revolution, would have prevented all progress. I mean, today there are people who claim that cell phones cause brain cancer. So should we ban cell phones? That's what the precautionary principle would tell us. Ban cell phones, ban computers because they emit some rays that might cause brain cancer. Precautionary principle is completely arbitrary and would destroy all economic progress.
The precautionary principle says prove that it's safe before you market it. The way that our laws are, and that's how it's done in Europe. The way
how would you prove that cell phones are safe?
Please, one sentence here, you're on. the laws in the United States say you may market it until somebody comes along and proves that it's dangerous. So we have 60,000 chemicals in our chemical stream in the United States. Fewer than 400 have ever been tested for safety on humans. And, you know, setting aside the 600 or 700 that have been identified as toxins and carcinogens, more than half of which are still being sold. In Europe, the number of chemicals is about half that.
And that is why millions of people from around the world, including Europeans, would at a drop of the hat move to the United States.
So their kids can be deformed?
But they would, because in spite of all of that, the progress that is allowed by the freedoms that exist in the United States far exceeds the risks that are involved.
The freedom to have uterine cancer and to be sterile as a young man, that freedom,
look,
is that the freedom you're talking
people,
about?
The number of people that are sterile and the number of people with that kind of cancer is small, and the fact is, and
it's,
the fact
it's
is that
huge, Ron. Yeah, the average
to,
age of, me, of menstruation of onset. The average age. Hang on just a second. Average age of onset of menstruation in girls in the United States was consistent for 400 years, and in the last 20 years, it's dropped by 2 years. That's huge. Yep. That's a huge evolutionary leap. And the only thing that anybody can come up with is that this is exposure to estrogen-mimicking chemicals, and phthalates are right at the top of that list.
And menstruation, I'm not arguing the particulars of this case, but in menstruation in Europe has not dropped at all.
It is starting to. They're starting to catch up with us in some ways. Yeah, and just by coincidence, at about the same time that they started buying into the Thatcher Reagan free trade mantra, and they started buying all this crap from China.
I'm not going to argue the particulars of this case. As I said, if this turns out to be poison, then it should be banned. But to claim that the United States is somehow a worse place to live than Europe because we have
I'm not suggesting
than
it
Europe.
Is.
Is
There's a whole lot of reasons it's why just, this is the
ridiculous.
Is a wonderful country you're on. Come on.
This
but the fact of the matter is
because
that
we have the freedom to progress and to advance and to try new things, and yes, sometimes
and to kill a few
things,
people while we're doing it.
There are risks involved in trying new things. There's no way to live. I mean, what you're trying to do is promise people a risk-free society.
I am not.
Which doesn't exist. The precautionary
and you're trying to create a utopia based on everybody following their own greed, and you think that that's going to produce a wonderful world, and that has never
existed.
Absolutely,
the precautionary
name one country
that is
objectivist and it works.
We do not want the stagnation that Europe is experiencing today and that this country is going to experience in the future.
Please name one country where your philosophy has worked, Iran.
What's that?
Please name one country where your philosophy has worked.
Well, my philosophy has never been tried.
All of human history.
My philosophy has never been tried. And to the extent that it's tried, it has produced the greatest abundance in human history. That is in places like the United States during the late 19th century and in places like Hong Kong.
During the late 19th century when we were hugely socializing our railroads, we were massive government giveaways to our railroads.
To the extent that there was government intervention. To the extent that there was government intervention during that period, we didn't benefit as much as we could have from the wonders of capitalism.
All right. We always end up back here. You're on,
yes,
Brooke,
we do.
The executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. You can get the whole argument there. It's a great website. You're on. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, as always.
Always good talking with you, and happy holidays to you.
You too.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Should we all become engineers?
This is the Tom Hartman program.
The hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act, Teamster.org, the website. And, hey, we get mail, you know.
You know it's nice when the postman has a letter in his sack for you, because the mail must go through. The mail must go through.
Yeah, I got this one from Jason. Toss out people's last names just on the assumption that some people still like some anonymity. But Jason, thank you for the email. He says, I hope you read this on the air because it's vital to your listeners to become more aware of the robotic spies from the planet Xenon that exist among us. I listen to your show every day at work and otherwise would not have known of the importance of what I've seen. I live in South Florida. I work for Florida Power and Light as a restoration specialist. Yesterday at approximately 10 a.m., I was dispatched to an out-of-service call to investigate and restore service if possible. What I found when I arrived was very surprising. There was a disabled pigeon at the base of the... Yeah, there we go. A disabled pigeon at the base of the pole with lines feeding the customer. I say disabled because something that was never alive can't possibly be dead. Immediately, I noticed several things that were very suspicious. The robot bird was stiff, laying chest down and perfectly symmetrical. Both wings spread out halfway, and its neck and head were dead center, looking down. Looking up at the pole, I noticed it had taken out all three phases. Normally, when a bird gets where it doesn't belong, he only takes out one or at the most two phases. It would take a deliberate act to take out all three. Looking back down at the bird robot, I noticed there was little evidence of burns and no blood. An animal of that size that gets across one phase in ground is normally obliterated. Keep in mind that this pigeon crossed all three phases, energized at 7,620 volts apiece. There was a nickel-sized hole in its back with a yellowish-white substance coming out, similar to the viscosity of blood or hydraulic fluid. I didn't take the specimen because there were other pigeons above watching me, and I didn't want them to know that I knew. That could make me a target. Instead, I went aloft, quickly refused the switches, restoring service to the customer, got back in my truck, went to speak to the customer. I found up a gentleman in his mid-20s working alone on a Sunday at a credit reporting agency. He stated that he was in the middle of some important work when he heard the explosion the pigeon caused, and the power went out, wiping out his computer. I didn't want to alarm him, so I simply told him a pigeon was the cause and left. I hope he listens to your show and realizes the significance. Mm-hmm. Be careful when you're doing important work. 24 minutes past the hour. June in Portland, Oregon. Hey, June, what's up?
Oh, hi. Well, it's about, I don't trust the pharmaceutical industry. There's a nonstop message. The pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, money-making industries, nonstop message of fear on radio and TV about some new disease or some disease that's around a long time, and the wonderful medication that they have that we must take. And then there's this long, long list of possible side effects. So I'm 84. My son's a doctor. I run all my ideas past him. And I take no medication, only aspirin for arthritis. So I'm a powerful believer in exercise and the mind-body connection. So
your bottom line is that the pharmaceutical industry also is not to be trusted, and I'm with you on that, June. By the way, Tracy Shelton, a consumer attorney for the New York Public Interest Research Group, says the researchers for the reports attest over 1,500 popular children's toys for harmful chemicals such as lead, arsenic, mercury, and others. Quote, one in three of the toys that were tested were found to contain medium to high levels of chemicals of concerns. This did not happen, or it did not happen in the recent past when we made toys in the United States. Lucas in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Lucas.
Yeah, what's happening, Tom?
Hey.
I'm not sure if I can follow Jason's email there. But,
Well, here's the thing on Jason's email is that, you know, nobody's ever seen a dead pigeon. Nobody's ever seen a baby pigeon. They're actually robots in the planet Xenu. And whenever there's meetings of world leaders or important things going on, what do you have? You have pigeons. They're spying on us. That's what's going on. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I do internet radio, and it's based in the UK. And I'm in contact with a lot of UKers and people from Switzerland, France, all over the world.
Right.
And I just want to go against the statement that your guest made that people from Europe would like to move to the United States at the drop of the hat.
Yeah.
That's just not true. They're happy where they are. And
yeah, I'll tell you, I lived in Europe for a year, and I've been doing business in Europe for almost 30 years. And I know very few Europeans who want to do anything other than vacation here. And when you go to Europe, like when we did our show from Denmark, we found a lot of Danes or a lot of Americans living in Denmark. And I know a lot of Americans living in Germany. There's a lot of expats, American expats, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of American expats who are saying, hey, yeah, we kind of like the free health care over here. And we kind of like the, you know, good job security and the decent jobs and the good wages and the high minimum wage and a high quality of life and organic food, you know, relatively speaking, and safe toys.
That's what we need here, Tom.
Yeah,
thanks
yeah, it absolutely is. Sarah in Wenatchee, what's up, Sarah?
Oh, this is Tom Hartman.
It is, you're on the air.
What's that?
It is, and you're on the air, and we're just about out of time.
Okay, well, and regarding your discussion with this guy from the Ayn Rand Institute, you asked him about a country where this objectivism has been practiced. I was thinking that you know, it's practiced in these poor, undeveloped countries of the world where there is no regulation, children have to pay to go to school, and...
You're right. If you want to see where libertarianism, objectivism, and Tom Tancredo-style conservative economic policies or Robert Rubin-style policies are practiced, go to the Third World.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
And welcome back, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our live free video stream. Pakistan arrests a terror leader, somebody who is supposed to have commanded the Mumbai attacks, step by step. Well, GM CEO survived the bailout. Rick Wagoner might not make it through. He's still got enough millions in the bank that he can live forever. Mitt Romney is preparing for his 2012 run. That's definitely, tell you this, very definitely on the stack here. The Daily Beast, by the way, great news summary. Merrill Lynch's CEO wants his $10 million bonus. Oh, isn't that sweet? And he's probably going to get it. And, of course, this from the Post-Time Sun-Dispatch. The big three automakers announced that they have sold their executive private jets to Wall Street investment bankers. After the massive negative reaction we got when we flew our corporate jets on our first trip to Washington, said Rick Wagoner of General Motors, we realized we could never use them again. They were useless to us, and we had to take a great loss on them, said Alan Mulally of Ford. But we had to get some money, and the jets were the only transportation vehicle that Ford was able to sell this month. Chrysler's jet was purchased by Goldman Sachs, who plans to give it as a gift to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson when he returns to the firm after his term is up in January. Goldman CEO Lloyd C. Blankenfeld said, Henry really helped us out. We had to do something with all that extra money he got for us, so it's the least we could do to pay him back to give him Ford's corporate jet. We even added a hot tub and booked several well-endowed massage therapists for his maiden voyage. Mullally, who not only sold his jet but his Ford Escape Hybrid, will be bicycling to Washington to continue his talks with Congress to try and get aid for his ailing company. He says, I wanted to show we were serious about making changes and sacrifices around Ford, said Mullally from his Motel 6 in Ashtabula, Ohio, after the second day of his bike ride from Detroit. Yeah, that works. 866-303-2270, our phone number, Jim in Southern Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's up?
How you doing, sir?
Well, I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Jim?
Well, I tried to get through to you Friday when you had brunch with Bernie on there. I had a question about the auto bailout that I've never heard anybody ask before.
Right.
What good is it going to do to save the auto companies if their credit markets are so tight the average worker person can't go out and buy a new car?
Well, these are all part of the same whole, Jim. We've got a multidimensional fabric, and it's a good question, multidimensional fabric to our economy that we need to be looking at all the pieces of. The big problem, the real bottom line horrible problem, is that we're not right now at this particular moment we're not building much in the United States. I mean, you know, when people go on TV and they say, you know, 1 in 10 jobs in America depends directly or indirectly on the auto industry, we should be saying, what the hell? Are you kidding? Because we don't make televisions in the United States anymore. We don't make computers in the United States anymore. We don't make socks in the United States anymore. We don't make shirts or shoes or jeans in the United States anymore. We don't make anything in the United States anymore. And because we have no manufacturing industry, we have a terrible national security problem. Remember World War II? Roosevelt said, okay, to the big three, you are now making tanks. Boom. They were. He said to the airplane companies, to Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and all the others. Actually, it was McDonnell and Douglas. He says, you're now making airplanes. He said to the companies that were making nylon stockings. They don't exist in the United States anymore, by the way. You are making parachutes. And on and on and on. We can't do that anymore. We can't do that anymore. We just don't make anything. Tim, by the way, sent a great suggestion. I thought this was absolutely brilliant. Tim says, have the big three rebuild most of the U.S. Postal Service's local delivery fleet using hybrid and plug-in technology. This could be done with a combination of prepayments and loans. So in other words, instead of not just bailing out the big three, but we go to them and we say, okay, your first job is to make new vehicles, brand new vehicles for the entire Postal Service. According to Tim's research, and I haven't verified this, but it looks like it might be right. I know Mike Toth is very knowledgeable about these, and I'm guessing that he'll send me an email and set me straight on this one way or the other within the next day or so. I'll report back to you, Mike, who does our archives. But his suggestion is that the United States Postal Service is one of the largest users of oil and gasoline in the United States outside of the military, which just makes sense. I mean, you know, they've got all these vehicles. They're delivering mail all over the country. So if all of their vehicles were replaced with plug-in electric vehicles, it would, number one, rescue the big three and save thousands of jobs. It would dramatically advance that technology. In fact, it would promote research into those technologies, and it would allow the big three to retool for, you know, making a whole broader range of those kind of vehicles. I think it's a great idea. Tim, tip of the hat to you. Thank you very much. Well said, well done. Ken in Long Beach. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was going to say, in reference to that Ayn Rand caller guy that was saying how everyone in the world wants to come here, mm-hmm. It's kind of a paradox I call it of the two borders. Mexico, everybody wants to leave the country. That's the country that does things his way. Canada, practically nobody wants to leave, and it's 20 degrees below zero there in the winter, I think, and yet they don't want to come here.
Yeah, excellent.
You know?
Excellent.
Know why?
Again, you want
to be a socialist country,
right? When you want to see, and although Yaron would say that, you know, none of them have been perfectly objectivist enough, if they only were, that it would be a paradise. But if you want to see conservative economics played out on a grand scale, visit any third world country. And I've been to a bunch of them, and you're absolutely right.
And he mentioned Hong Kong, by the way. Hong Kong is exactly what we don't want to be. Hong Kong is very rich people and very poor people.
Yes, yeah.
That's the Hong Kong.
I've spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. I've done a lot of business in Hong Kong, and you're absolutely right. And people are packed in, you know, 6, 8, 10 people to an apartment, and it is just incredible. Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. Jack in Sacramento. Hey, Jack.
Yes. Hi. Hi, honey. Is this Tom Hartman?
You are on the air.
I'm on the show.
You are?
Okay, well, I sure enjoy your show, and I'm from Portland, and I understand you live in a boathouse, and I love that area out there on the Willamette. But anyway, here's my idea. It's probably crazy. I want to stop all the foreclosures and do a moratorium and see which non-speculators we can help. But I'd also like to go backwards. I'd like to see if we can't buy houses of people that have lost houses. The idea is to get construction to create a need again for houses and create a lot of jobs. I don't know, it might be totally crazy. What do you think?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. Number one, if we're saying, gee, let's recreate our economy by creating, and there was a subtext, by the way, in what Obama said on Meet the Press on Sunday of this, let's recreate the economy by getting the value in people's homes back so that they can continue to use their homes as ATM machines to finance their lifestyle because they no longer have decent paying jobs. I think that that's a terrible mistake. I do think it's a really good idea to do whatever we can to help people stay in their homes and to allow people, since most middle class people, their home is their major investment, it's their major source of equity, to allow people to build that equity in their homes and, you know, over time have that good investment. But if the plan is to say, okay, let's reinflate the bubble, let's go back to another bubble economy, I think that that's a bad plan and not one that we should pursue, frankly. Michael in Port Angeles. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that Obama's been saying he wants to recreate the infrastructure in the United States, build the economy back up, and also green jobs. I think one of the best things we could do is electrify the train system. Electric trains, this is a technology that's used all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
We could take the trucks off the roads so they're not using petroleum so much. We could put people in trains instead of cars, and it's proven technology.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The thing that makes oil, and it was interesting to see the 60 Minutes special this weekend where Leslie Stahl went over there and was not running around in a burqa, oddly enough. The thing that makes oil a resource over which countries are willing to go to war and doesn't make salt one, although salt was, before the invention of refrigeration, actually a resource over which countries go to war because it was essential for preserving food, meat and fish in particular, and so it became a strategic commodity. Oil is a strategic commodity in the United States for only one reason, or primarily one reason, and that is transportation. We only generate 2% of our electricity with oil. It's not electricity. It is transportation. Nearly 100%, over 95% of our transportation is fueled by oil or gasoline, products of oil, gasoline, diesel fuel, things like that. And if we could change that, oil would no longer be a strategic commodity to the United States. And we should have been doing that, you know, we should have started in the 50s, frankly, when L. King Hubbard was first projecting that the Hubbard peak would hit the United States in 1974, as it did, and would hit the world around 2000, as it has. So, anyhow, yesterday, by the way, I mentioned Meet the Press. I have to share this with you. This is Tom Brokaw asking Barack Obama a question about the auto companies, and this is the conservative talking point, basically. Why don't we force them into bankruptcy so that we can destroy all their unions, number one. I mean, Brokaw doesn't come out and explicitly say that, but why don't we force them into bankruptcy, which would blow up the unions and blow up the pension funds, and then put somebody like Jack Welch in charge? Remember, Jack Welch was the CEO of General Electric. Jack Welch is the guy who in his autobiography bragged about how back in the 80s, 70s or 80s, as CEO of GE, he went over to India to do business, you know, to promote some trade with GE, and noticed that there were all these people who spoke English. And he thought, look at there's all these people who speak English, and they're willing to work for 50 cents an hour. And he invented the modern American practice of outsourcing back office functions, accounting and call center functions, to India. This was Jack Welch. Here's Tom Brokaw.
Tom Rossi, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the Wall Street Journal, has said we ought to have a government-structured bankruptcy and maybe even an automobile czar of some kind. One name that has come up is Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, the parent company of NBC.
I mean, is that incredible? Obama should have said in that moment, Jack Welch, are you crazy? He's the guy who started outsourcing everything to India. But, of course, Obama's more of a diplomat than I am, which is why he's, you know, president and I'm not. 45 minutes past the hour.
visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Children for a presidential ribbon. They don't understand. I think it's time for change. Time to rearrange. The world's got strange. Yeah. I think it's time. It's time for change.
And for our listeners in Portland, Oregon, by the way, just a quick heads up. Wednesday of this week, 3 days hence, Wednesday night at 7:30, I'll be doing a book signing at Powell's Burnside location, the main store there, Powell's Bookstore, the world famous, and the place that I have to be very careful about going to Powell's because it is so addictive. I mean, this is like a city block, multiple stories. I have no idea how many square miles or square feet. I know it's hundreds of thousands of square feet, miles and miles of books. And, you know, Louise and I will walk into Powell's and say, you know, stop at Whole Foods and pick up some lunch or go over to P.F. Chang's and have a snack or something. Let's wander into Powell's. 4 hours later, I'm staggering out with three bags full of books. It invariably happens. So I warn you, it's dangerous and addictive. But anyhow, in Portland on Wednesday this week, 7:30, I'll be doing a book signing. The paperback edition of Cracking the Code is out. Also, our new book, Legacy of Secrecy, is out with Lamar Waldron, and I'm assuming that Powell's will have many of my other titles available as well, and that should be a hoot. Seven myths about the Detroit automakers, by the way. I just wanted to quickly share this with you, and then we'll get back to your phone calls here. Mark Phelan writing in the Free Press, the Detroit Free Press. Number one, nobody buys their vehicles. That's one of the myths. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler sold 8.5 million vehicles in the United States last year and millions more around the world. GM outsold Toyota by about 1.2 million vehicles in the U.S. last year and holds a U.S. lead over Toyota of 700,000. Globally, GM in 2007 remained the world's largest automaker, selling over 9 million vehicles worldwide, more than Toyota. Ford outsold Honda by about 850,000 and Nissan by more than 1.3 million. Chrysler sold more vehicles than Nissan and Hyundai combined, both in 2007 and this year. Myth number two, they build unreliable junk. Reality, the creaky, leaky vehicles of the 80s and 90s are long gone. Consumer Reports has found that Ford's reliability is now on par with good Japanese automakers. The independent J.D. Power quality study scored Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, Ford, GMC, Mercury, Pontiac, and Lincoln brands' overall quality as higher than that of Acura, Audi, BMW, Honda, Nissan, Scion, Volkswagen, and Volvo. In fact, the highest quality midsize sedan of all of those companies, according to J.D. Power, the Chevy Malibu. And I'm sorry, myth number three, they build gas guzzlers. The reality, all of the Detroit 3 build midsize sedans that the EPA rates at 29 to 33 miles per gallon. The most fuel efficient, the Chevy Malibu, 33 miles in the gallon. That's 2 miles per gallon better than the best Honda Accord. So they're making very fuel-efficient cars. Myth number four, they already got a $25 billion bailout. No, they didn't. None of that money has been lent out and may not for more than a year. In fact, that's the money that they're thinking of tapping into right now. They never got the money. Number five, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are idiots for investing in pickups and SUVs. Well, the reality, the domestic lineup has been truck-heavy, but Toyota, Nissan, Mercedes-Benz, and BMW have spent billions of dollars on pickups and SUVs because trucks are a large and historically profitable part of the auto industry. The most fuel-efficient pickups are from Ford, GM, and Chrysler. They all have higher EPA fuel economy ratings than Toyota and Nissan's full-size pickups. Myth number six, they don't build hybrids. Well, they got into it late, but actually Ford and GM now offer more hybrid models than Honda or Nissan, with several more due to hit the road next year. Myth number seven, their union workers are lazy and overpaid. Actually, Chrysler tied Toyota as the most productive automaker in North America this year, according to the Harbor Report on Manufacturing. 8 of the 10 most productive vehicle assembly plants in North America belong to Chrysler, Ford, or General Motors. This off-site and nonsense BS $70 an hour wage and benefit figure for UAW workers inaccurately adds in benefits of millions of retirees and divides the total only by current employees. It's simply wrong. It's a lie. Hourly pay for assembly line workers tops out at $28 an hour. Benefits add about $14. New hires at the Detroit 3 get $14 an hour. No pension or health care when they retire, but benefits raise their hourly total to $29 when they're working. UAW wages are now comparable with Toyota workers. So there has been a great leveling, you know, for those people who think that that's a good idea. I personally don't. I think it's a tragedy that everybody is sinking to the lowest common denominator. But, you know, that's where we're at. David in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, David, what's up?
Well, I try to write down all those things that you just mentioned, but I can't write that fast.
It's freep.com is the Detroit Free Press's website, freep.com. And
okay.
If you go into our chat room, actually, I think it was Fred 3 put a link to it. But at the title, and you can also Google it, it's the title of the article. It's by Mark Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N. It's called Seven Myths About Detroit Automakers.
Okay, well, I did get some down, and I want to hold you on the phone while I read the article online. My main comment, what I said to your screener, was this. You said they built the myth is that they build cars that nobody wants.
Right.
And then you mentioned that they sold 9 million or something versus a million more than Toyota.
Right.
I don't
globally,
think
GM, yeah. Domestically, Ford, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler outsell Toyota.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But based on what they sold in the 50s, where GM had like 55% of the market, Ford had about 25%, Chrysler had about 10 to 12, that's the comparison to make.
Sure.
Why did they go from 95% of the market down to less than 50% all told?
I would say for two reasons. Number one, in the 1950s, if Toyota wanted to sell a car in the United States, they had to pay an import tariff. They had to
right.
pay a tax when that car was imported. Now they don't, number
okay.
one. And number
well,
two, because our trade imbalance has been so bad over the years with Japan and China and these other companies, particularly Japan and South Korea, those companies have ended up with hundreds of billions of dollars that they had to spend somewhere. So what they did is they came here to the United States and they built factories. Now, down in Alabama, you got Jeff Sessions, who I think is from Alabama, being very sanctimonious on the Sunday shows about the whole Big Three thing and all this stuff. You know, we don't know. Maybe we should let them go out of business. Well, down in Alabama, they gave the state... gave either Toyota or Nissan, I forget which one it was, I think it was Toyota, gave them over $200,000 per job created in corporate tax breaks.
Can you hold me over, Tom, or is that not possible?
If they would, pardon?
Can you hold me over? There's a lot I want to talk about.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I can't, David, and we're moving on. But this is where it's so wrong. It's just our insane trade policy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I want to shift gears a little bit. There was a Supreme Court decision in the state of Montana last week that mirrors a decision that was made here in the state of Oregon twice, not by our legislature or our Supreme Court, but by the voters of this state. Which says that the government does not have the right to force you to live in pain. So the question, does the government have the right to force you to live in pain? In all but two states in the union, the answer is yes. If somebody is in terminal, late-stage cancer, they're in excruciating pain, they're saying, you know, this is horrible. I want to end it now. In all but two states in the union, their doctor cannot help them end their lives in any way without the risk of going to prison forever. Dr. Jack Kevorkian, as best I know, is still in jail in Michigan. Remember Dr. Death? He was helping people, you know, a physician-assisted suicide. He would, you know, put together a little machine for them. The way that they do it here in Oregon is pretty straightforward. You have to have two doctors, both, sign off on the fact that you are terminal and have less than 6 months to live. A, and B, and this is, now I'm not representing myself as an expert on this, but perhaps somebody from Oregon will call and fill in some of the details on this, but B, that there is some significant loss of quality of life that would justify the end of your life, like you're in incredible pain or you can't function or you can't move or whatever. And in fact, what they do is they give you a large overdose, typically of a drug called pentobarbital, sometimes secobarbital. These are barbiturates. And you take a very, very large dose of these barbiturates and you go to sleep and don't wake up. And in fact, here in Oregon, the median number of minutes from the time somebody takes the drug and the time they die last year was 26 minutes, the year before 25 minutes, the year before that 20 minutes. So on average, about a little less than a half hour, somebody takes the pill or the pills or they drink the liquid and then they fall asleep and don't wake up. But you have to have two doctors sign off on this. It is legal in Oregon. We passed that as a ballot initiative because the legislature didn't have the guts to do it. Same with medical marijuana here, by the way. And then the right wingers freaked out, took it to court, got it unturned or got it rolled back. I wasn't here living in the state at the time that happened. This is when I was living in Vermont. So I don't know the details of that, but it somehow got pushed back. And so it went back on the ballot again. And again, the good citizens of the state said, no, we really want to have the right to die with dignity. Now, here's what's interesting. In the latest year for which we can find statistics, internationaltaskforce.org has the statistics for Oregon's assisted suicide laws, 2005. In 2005, there were 64 prescriptions written in this state, 38 of them used. The year before that, 60 prescriptions were written, 37 of them were used. The year before that, 68 prescriptions written, 42 of them used. In other words, about two-thirds of the time, people are given prescriptions, between half and two-thirds, people are given prescriptions for life-ending drugs. And what happens, and I remember, you know, for years I did a morning show. I still do. I still participate in it, but I did it all by myself, or I did it with one other person here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland. And this issue was a hot political issue about 3 years ago, again, here in the state. And I had on a physician who prescribes these kinds of drugs. And he said what very often happens is somebody has cancer, they're at the end of their life, life sucks, and they come to me and they say, you know, I want the life-ending drugs. And they get the prescription and they set it on the desk next or on the table next to their bed. And then every day they wake up and they say, you know, I can do one more day. The pain isn't quite that bad. I can do one more day. And they just look at the prescription. And he said, you know, a lot of the time, they die of natural causes before they ever get around to taking the drugs. And they do it calmly, whereas without knowing that a person could end their own life, he said you get people who are just absolutely frantic. And this is where you get these god-awful, messy suicides where people shoot themselves in the head and blow their brains all over the wall, or try to slit their wrists and can't do it right and don't know how to do it right or whatever and end up, you know, just making terrible messes and in some states then end up in psychiatric facilities or in suicide watches even though they're 3 months from dying. Or medicated to the point where they're numb and drooling with antipsychotics or things like this. Now, of course, one of the first things that a physician looks for is somebody who is depressed, because depression is typically one of the things that goes along with a terminal diagnosis and with cancer. And if that depression can be treated with antidepressant drugs, do that first. I mean, they have to have ruled out everything. So in Montana now, Judge Dorothy McCarter issued a ruling, this was last Friday, that Billings man with terminal cancer who'd sued the state along with four doctors who treat terminally ill patients. She said, the Montana constitutional rights of individual privacy and human dignity taken together encompass the right of a competent, terminally ill patient to die with dignity. The patient's right to die with dignity, she said, includes protection of the patient's physician from liability under the state's homicide statutes. And that's what Jack Kevorkian in Michigan is in jail for, is participating in homicides. Or you know, he being accused of homicide, the individual's committing suicide. So why are the people in Oregon, why do they take their own lives? When they did a survey of this over an eight-year period, they asked these people who had these prescriptions, fear of being a burden. Out of the, for example, in the year 2005, out of the 64 prescriptions that were written for life-ending drugs, only 38 were used. 16 people said that there was the fear of being a burden. 30 of the 64 said fear of losing autonomy. 17, now people had multiple reasons, of course. 17 of the 64 said fear of losing control of their bodily functions. 9 of the 64 said that the pain medication was not keeping the pain at bay. 34, about half, cited fear of loss of dignity. So here, you know, here you have it. Should the state have the power to say, no, you can't take your own life? I watched my father dying, and he died of mesothelioma, which is a terrible, terrible form of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. And he was literally choking in his own blood. He had had a stroke the day before and was unable to talk or move and was choking in his own blood and crying. And the nurse was there. It was in our living room in our home, and my three brothers and my wife were there with me. And she had given him so much morphine, he was right up at the edge. And she looked at me and she said, you know, shall I give him more morphine? And I said, yeah, I think it looks like he's in a lot of pain. And she put some more morphine in his mouth, and within about 4 or 5 minutes, he quietly died. And, you know, I sat there with my hand on his shoulder as he died. And it was a very difficult thing. And yet, I suspect if she had not given him that very large dose of morphine, I suspect, at least in my mind, there was a subtext to our conversation, which was, do we want to prolong this or not? Although neither of us ever said it out loud, because had we, or had she, it would have been a crime in Michigan. And I hope I'm not confessing to a crime here on the radio. I don't think I am. I suspect that this is a scenario that is played out in, tragically, played out in people's homes, in hospices and hospitals all around the country every day. Let's just be honest about it. And I know that my dad, you know, 3 or 4 days before that, when he was in excruciating pain, he was taking 40 milligrams of morphine every couple hours. And he still had function. And I had this conversation with him about suicide. And he had said, well, maybe I can starve myself to death. I mean, this is just an incredibly tough thing. Should the state have the power to say, no, you can't take your own life, we will put your doctor in jail? I don't think so.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That time comes when you're that close to it. Should you be able to propel yourself across that door? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Do you have any experience with this? Have you had an experience like the one that I had? Or the opposite, something god awful. Not that mine wasn't, but, you know, at least it didn't go on for day after day after day, or week after week in some cases. 866-303-2270. Jay in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening to WLBY. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Yes, I have to agree with you in every way, shape, and form. And one of the things that gets me is the fact that we treat our animals better than we do ourselves.
Yep.
And one thing that I have to say, and this is about with lung cancer from smoking, they do the least amount as far as research. And we have lost one of the best people that I have ever known. Known outside. I don't know him personally, but you know what happened to Paul Newman.
Yeah.
And it is such a loss to everybody in our society and everywhere else, in any way, shape, and form. And to see that we, because this system and what it does, and they went and said it's an inner city, that you create this thing and that you should fail. That, I mean, by that, they didn't do enough research into lung, and they still don't.
Yeah.
They still don't.
No, Jay,
what a beautiful man, and what a beautiful man to our society.
Yeah, Jay, there are many of the, thank you for the comment. There are many, and that's the thing. There are, but yes, we need to do more research to save lives. But when the time comes, and the time will come for all of us, when the time comes, should we have some control over it? Elizabeth in Seattle, listening to Talk 1090. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, am I on air?
You are.
Oh, wonderful to talk to you, Tom. I am a huge fan. Your story, I'm sorry, I'm really nervous. Your story just really touched me because I went through the exact same thing with my grandmother.
Mm.
And the nurses were incredibly compassionate.
Yeah.
And there was a subtext to the conversation we had. You know, they came to me and I said, you know, she seems to be in pain, and they offered to give her another shot of morphine because it seemed to be time to do it on their chart. And I looked at her and I said, you just gave her one 5 minutes ago. And she said, not according to my chart.
Mm-hmm.
So those wonderful nurses just...
And isn't it a tragedy that we have to do this dance like this? And frankly, that it has to be done with morphine, which is, with the phenobarbital drugs, you know, it's
yeah.
Just go to sleep. It's a more appropriate drug if you want to try and end a person's life. And
yeah.
Frankly, what you and I are talking about are a third party making the decision. In Oregon, both of our experiences are still illegal.
Absolutely.
Because in Oregon, the person has to be able to take it themselves. In other words, they have to be able to pick that little glass of liquid secobarbital or pentobarbital. They have to be able to pick that up and pour it down their own throat.
Yeah.
So really what you and I are talking about is euthanasia, not assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide. Which is legal, by the way, in Holland, but is legal nowhere in the United States. And these are the ethical conundrums and the difficulties that we're dealing with. Elizabeth, thank you very much for the call. And to Jay's comment about we treat our pets better. You know, we had a dog. I've had dogs since I was born. The first dog I had as a little kid, Inky, I still remember. And then we had Thunder, we had a red setter, and then Louise and I, our last dog was Sabra, a dog that we had for 18 years. She was half Samoyan and half Golden Retriever, and just a wonderful dog. And when she was 18, 19 years old, she was blind, she was deaf, she couldn't stand, and when she finally reached the point, and we just kept going with her, until she reached the point where she was soiling all over her own bed and she was trembling and she was in pain. And at that point, we made the decision, you know, hey, it's time for Sabra to go. And even that was a very, very difficult one. Joe in Tempe, Arizona, you want to make some light of this, Joe?
Well, I'm a Sarah Palin Republican, and I just like to say it's against God to do. And basically, I'm surprised you said what you did before, because as a Sarah Palin Republican, I'd consider that borderline murder to be injecting your poor father with morphine. You know, miracles can happen. You liberals have destroyed this country. You've destroyed the morality of this country. And it just stuns me. And you don't want to admit it, but your own president, Barack Obama, has now become a Republican, and he's Robert Gates. He's not going to go along with any of this.
Yeah. Joe, thanks a lot for your comments. The Sarah Palin Republicans among us have been heard from. Oh, my. See, this is something I think that we really need to, among others. I mean, there's so many things in America that we need to be having reasonable and rational and honest discussions about. And yes, miracles do happen, but they don't happen when somebody's choking on their own blood. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
You want a guy, take what I get.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick reminder to our friends in Portland, Oregon, listening on AM 620 KPOJ. I'll be at Powell's Books on Burnside Wednesday night at 7:30, signing the paperback edition of Cracking the Code, and hopefully a whole bunch of others of my titles. So here we have, in Montana, a judge has ruled that what Dr. Jack Kevorkian was doing in Michigan, helping people avoid finding themselves in the situation my father found himself in, or our caller from Washington State found herself in, or her grandmother found herself in. Helping people avoid that by saying that if they are terminal, and if they are in great pain, and if it is the end of their life, and if they think it's appropriate, they can end their own lives with the help of their physician, with an overdose of presumably barbiturates is the typical way that it's been doing, that it's done. And your thoughts on this. Dennis in Riverside, California. Hey, Dennis.
Hi, Tom. I generally agree with all that you're saying, but I know in Nazi Germany in the 30s, euthanasia was the first thing that was legalized to, terminate people's lives. I mean, with their consent. But from there, it was an easy step. If someone is in a lot of pain and is not real coherent, and maybe a doctor or a family member thinks that, I'm sure they would want to go. It's just like a first step. It's an easier step.
You're saying this is like a gateway drug. But, Dennis, two things. Number one, the doctors here in this state that I've talked with, and I've talked with a couple of them on the air here, who are involved with this, they say that, A, when people have life-ending drugs sitting on the table next to them, they get calmer, they get more relaxed, and frankly, they're less likely ultimately to commit suicide in some messy way or period than somebody
right.
who doesn't have access to it, number one. And number two, let me just push back on your Nazi story. I lived in Germany for a year, and I read, Scheer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and what Hitler was doing in the 30s, was not, euthanasia to end people's lives at the end of a long and painful life. What Hitler was doing was following the eugenics policies that had been started in the United States. When I lived in Vermont, the Abenaki tribe in Vermont was ruled by the state Supreme Court not to be a legitimate tribe because they were all sterilized in the 30s. Well, it turns out there was a bunch of them who hid out. But we were sterilizing people in the United States who were mentally retarded, who were Native American, who were African American. We were withholding treatment, the famous Tuskegee experiments for, you know, of African Americans with syphilis. But eugenics was a big thing in the United States. Let's create a better race. Let's weed out the weak and inferior. And it moved from the United States and England, which is, it really started in the UK philosophically, but it was the United States that first used it. Hitler was using U.S. eugenics posters in his PR campaign for eugenics in Germany. And then he went from, and they created these mobile units where they would have a little truck that would go behind, a little trailer that would go behind a truck, and they would pump the exhaust fumes from the truck, from the truck directly into the trailer. And they would go to the homes or the hospitals, and they would take mentally retarded people or people who were very sick, but mostly mentally retarded people, and they would put them in these trailers in the back, and they'd pump, you know, the exhaust in there, and they would die of carbon monoxide poisoning. That was the entryway to the ultimate gassing of the Jews. And it was not an end-of-life issue. It was a let's-build-a-master-race issue. I'm not talking about building a master race here. I'm talking about death with dignity. It's a different thing. But your point is well made, Dennis. We need to be very, very careful about this. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
Hey, I'm not sure if you know, but this initiative passed in Washington this past November.
I beg your pardon?
And, yeah, Initiative 1000, it was the Death with Dignity Act.
Oh, that's right. Thank you for reminding me. Washington State now has the same law that Oregon does.
Absolutely. And I identify myself as a liberal. I voted for Governor Gregoire. I voted for Senator Obama. But there were two chief reasons that I had to vote against it, and I just kind of wanted to share them with you. I'm a 20-year-old college student, so I try to be a competent voter. And I read through the entire text of the act, and there were two reasons that made me vote against it. The first one was that it lists the cause of death as the barbiturate overdose. It doesn't list, it lists the disease that the patient had as the cause of death instead of the barbiturate overdose. And that's, in essence, to me, at least falsifying a death certificate. So that was one thing. The other thing is, it seemed to me that HMOs that didn't want to provide care to someone could convince a competent adult that this is a resort that they could take without actually providing care.
Yes.
And I didn't really like that. So those were the two things.
Yeah, that's the thing that gives all of us the creeps, is that, you know, we put our parents or our grandparents into a nursing home, and the nursing home at some point decides that this person is more trouble than they're worth, or they're not profitable, although, frankly, I can't imagine that being the case, but it might be under a national health care system. And this is the big concern with the experiment in Holland, and that elderly people are simply being essentially executed because they're inconvenient or they're a hassle or they're expensive. And none of us want to see that. None of us want to go there. But I really don't think that this is a nonstop path down that road. Time will tell.
Yeah.
But Chris, I respect your concerns.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. And thanks for the call. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Stacy in Los Angeles, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Stacy.
Hey, good morning, Tom. First of all, Dr. Kevorkian was released from jail last year.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Jack Kevorkian was released from prison last year.
Oh, he was. Oh, good.
Yeah,
so Jack Kevorkian is free now. Good.
He did a couple of interviews. He's one of my heroes. I mean, I know he's creepy, but I respect him so much for standing up for this. And all I wanted to say was, to me, this all boils down to the issue of choice. And it's the same thing with an abortion. If you don't believe in it and you don't think it's the right way to go, then don't do it. But who, I don't know if that guy from Arizona was a put on, the guy that called himself a Palin Republican, if that was a put on or if he was for real. He thinks that your father choking in his own blood, that he should stay alive because it's not his choice to make.
Yeah.
I lost my father too, and I watched him, and I'm very grateful because my father never was in any pain. But when he came home and he decided to have hospice, the first day I said, I want morphine here because if he needs it, I don't want to have to wait for it. And we were very fortunate because I never even had to crack the seal on the bottle.
Yeah.
But I watched my father, and I know that he, if he were in pain, he wouldn't have wanted to stay around. Who does?
Yeah.
Who would want that?
Yeah. And this is the tough thing, is that there are folks who say, by and large, because of their religion, their religious convictions. But on the other hand, you have folks like our last caller who have serious ethical and legitimate ethical concerns. And this is why this has to be so narrowly circumscribed. who are saying, no, the government should have the right to tell you that you must be, we are going to force you to live in pain for an extra day, an extra week, an extra month, whatever it may be. We are going to force you to live in pain in your last few days. And I think that that's just wrong. Stacy, thank you very much. And well said. Kim in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Tom. My dad was a doctor. He has passed away himself. Thank God he did not pass away in any pain. But I can tell you this. This has been going on for a long, long time.
Yeah.
That there were silent agreements between, whether spoken or unspoken, between families, between the patient, him or herself, and the doctor and the nurses, and there's a consensus brought, and there is an understanding. At least back when my dad practiced, this was done by many, many doctors under many, many circumstances.
Yeah.
All of them when the patient had no further options, when there was not only no quality of life, there was little life left except for suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just understood, if you, for God's sakes, if you had a dog or a cat that has been hit by a car and you watch that dog or cat on the curb suffering for each breath, can you not, out of the depth of your heart, say, I cannot watch this suffering anymore?
Right.
There is no quality of life. There is nothing but suffering. And I thank God that I didn't have to watch my dad like you did. I'm grateful to God, but I love that nurse that said that to you. I'm afraid, sometimes I worry that to be codified into law, it might lead to some really unethical practices. It is done now. It has always been done under individual circumstances. So anybody that thinks, oh my God, this is absolutely terrible, it should never happen, it's been happening for a very long time.
Yeah. I'm sure this goes, back as far as human history. Kim, thank you very much. Well said. Lynn in Kirkland, Washington. Lynn, we have just a minute here before the break.
Yes, Tom, I just wanted to follow up and actually support your comment about having some drugs available to someone who is near death. My mother was had cancer, just went through just a horrific, horrific, painful experience. But just knowing that there was something nearby really helped calm her down a lot. And it was kind of an agreement, as your previous caller said, a silent agreement between myself and her doctor and my mother, that this would be available to her at the very end if the pain just got so bad. And that's what really worried her.
Yeah. Thank you, Lynn. It needs to come out of the shadows. You know, we need to just start being honest about this and upfront about it so that it doesn't go over the edge, right? So it doesn't start showing up in inappropriate ways in assisted living centers and things like that. Montana has ruled assisted suicide is legal. Washington State just voted for it. It's the law here in Oregon. What about the country?
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Montana has ruled assisted suicide is legal. Washington State has voted for it. It's been the law in Oregon for 8 years. What about the rest of the country? Jerry in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Jerry, your thoughts?
Hi. First of all, thanks for tackling the subject, and thanks for being a great host by listening to the people who are calling. I support you 100%. It doesn't matter if you're a Palin Republican or whatever. It's about being human. I, like you, held my mother's hand when she died of lung cancer. and she begged me, do something, do something. She was in so much pain. People don't understand. It's not about you watching your dear people suffer. It's about their suffering and your ability to, you know, help them on some level. My mother smoked for 50 years. I just lost a good friend to cancer. My mother-in-law, lung cancer. You know, they became addicted. Yes, I know, you know, the story behind that, but they should not have to suffer in their final days. I support you 100%.
Thank you, Jerry. Very well said, and thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Tom in Oceanside, California. Hey, Tom.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm well.
You know, I lived through a lot of the same thing with my dad. He became an invalid, and for 7 years he lost mobility. And over 4 months, we had to watch him die, and he finally got septic, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody's really missing the point with this whole conversation, in that this is a democracy, and these propositions that us voters vote on and approve, actually, instead of what gives the right the government to stop us from killing our loved ones or letting our loved ones die with dignity, what gives them the right to overturn the props that we pass?
Yeah. That's true. And this is where, you know, in Oregon, we had to pass this proposition twice to make it stick. In fact, you could phrase the question differently. What gives government the right to force people to live in pain? I don't see that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Constitution, although you say, well, you know, the government is here to support the right to life, but to enforce life when it is beyond the pale? I don't think so. Tom, excellent point.
The sick person knows. My dad knew that when he wanted to live, he would fight.
Yeah.
But there comes a point in everybody's life when their life is spent and they can't fight. Yeah. And then it's up to us as loved ones, or even them if they can still make that decision, when is it time?
Yeah. Well said. Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the call. Grace in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Grace, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to share a couple of experiences with end-of-life issues. Here in Oregon, the law that's legal is called death with dignity. And it's not quite as dignified as it sounds. My husband applied for that. At the age of 77, he had an arrhythmia that could not be stopped, even though medical people tried to do surgery and all kinds of interventions, and he was quite wretched. He finally decided life wasn't worth living and applied for death with dignity. And then we understood slowly how many hoops he had to go through. 3 weeks before he died, a psychiatrist who he was required to see 3 times offered him shock therapy for depression. He was depressed. He said he was depressed. He didn't want to have shock therapy. He wanted some assistance. Anyway, the day he died was the day they finally called and said he was approved. He thought that it was a shot. That was easy. It wasn't. In order to kill yourself that way, you have to take a glass full of pills unassisted, be able to swallow them, and drink water down. I don't think he could have done that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he died that way. I have a friend who had advanced cancer, was taken from the hospital where she was on feeding tubes and went to hospice house here in Portland. They did not put any tubes back in her, and she died very peacefully a few days later. They offered sips of water, ice, and that was a peaceful death. They gave her pain relief.
Right.
Recently, a friend of mine who's elderly and did not want to go back and forth to the hospital and go through the kind of things that many of us have seen, just decided to stop eating and drinking on his own. And he sucked on ice, and he died very peacefully. And in my mind,
That was the right thing. That is the only thing left to us is...
Yeah. Do you remember, Grace, that cover story in the Oregonian from 2 years ago, I think it was, about the woman here in Portland who chose to end her own life very publicly, called the press in, and she did it simply by stopping eating and drinking, and after four days, I think, or something?
That's the old-fashioned way. My husband said his grandfather did that a
that's
long
right.
time ago.
And she just quietly...
Yeah. And I think as long as there's pain relief, that people who are still in possession of their ability to think and speak need to take control of their own end.
But here's the problem is in some cases, look at what happened with Terry Schiavo in Florida. I mean, in some cases, people come in and they say, oh, yeah, but we're going to take charge of your life. We're going to shove feeding tubes down your throat. We're going to pump air into your lungs. And people are just saying, no, it's the end. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I agree. I think there has to be all the proper papers signed and the family intervention to keep that from happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's. Thank you, Grace. Thank you. Your comment was very eloquent, and I appreciate it. And I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your husband. This is, I think it's a great thing, frankly, that Montana's Supreme Court has made this ruling, and that two states now have passed these kinds of laws, citizen initiatives, in both cases, as I'm pretty sure with Washington State as well. The legislature didn't have the guts to do it. But it's, the people saying, this is what we want. This and medical pot would be kind of nice, too.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, speaking of deathbeds, I know it's a lousy segue, but the middle class. This was last week when I was in New York, my debate with John Stossel, which, by the way, a few people have asked about. John, I was very favorably impressed. He seemed like a really neat, really nice and decent guy. It'll probably be on 2020 in February, assuming that it plays. But they spent 3 hours in the studio shooting me, and then I went over to ABC and spent an hour with John Stossel in front of a camera debating whether or not the middle class was dying. And I say, following our death with dignity in the last hour, the middle class is dying without dignity. The economy, these insane economic policies that have been promulgated since Ronald Reagan came into office the last 26 years, and yes, Bill Clinton was a piece of it with his the NAFTA and GATT and WTO and all these absolutely insane things, spitting in the face of Alexander Hamilton, who created our first national industrial policy in 1791, have wiped out at least 10 million manufacturing jobs in aggregate since Reagan came into office. And every day, more are going. And now in Chicago... And, of course, we're on the air in Chicago, although this show is delayed by 3 hours. But I know we have a lot of listeners who listen on our web stream in Chicago. And Marcus is going to try and open up some phone lines. So, in particular, if any of our Chicago listeners want to call in. Larry Spivak is with us. He is the executive director of AFSCME Council 31, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME.org is the website. And, Larry, you just came from Republic Doors and Windows. Do I have that right?
No, I came from a press conference, and let me clarify, I'm a regional director, not executive director.
Okay, regional director. Fine.
Yeah.
And the let's just set the backstory here. Republic Windows and Doors is a manufacturing company in the Chicago area, and they are operating, as most businesses do, with a line of credit. And the Bank of America said, sorry, we got our bailout from the government. We're going to pay our executives and our CEOs, they're millions, but we got no line of credit for you guys. Tough luck. And so Republic Windows and Doors said to their employees, well, that's it. That's the end. 200 people are losing their jobs with basically about a three-hour notice. Do I have that right?
Three-day notice.
Or three-day notice, yeah.
Yeah, three-day notice, right? Yeah. And they were in negotiations, and the company came in and just started moving out machinery and things like that, as opposed to the 75-day notice they're supposed to have in Illinois.
Right. So now we've got, so A, apparently the company violated the law, but their argument is, hey, we keep, you know, the bank made us do it. And now the workers are occupying the plant saying what?
Well, the workers are occupying the plant saying that we have vacation, we have pay, we have severance pay, this is all owed to us. And you're just walking away, a runaway shop, and we have, you know, when you start thinking about 200, 250 workers, you start thinking about 1,000 people are affected by this immediately,
sure.
Their families right before the holidays. So it's like a huge gut-busting event for workers in this country in one place. And if this company gets away with this, others will do it as well. I should just add one thing, that the company appears to be opening up another factory in Iowa at the same time, and that's probably where the machinery is going, because there they can pay lower wages. This is a union contract, and so we think that's what's happening.
So what we have here is perhaps a company using the situation with the bank as a rationale or an excuse for actually union busting.
I believe that's what's taken place, as many other people do.
Yeah.
We just came from a press conference at City Hall where there were many, many aldermen and other dignitaries there, and county commissioners speaking in support of the workers. And they're about to say, pass a resolution to withdraw all the city and county's money from the Bank of America, which amounts to probably close to $1 billion if Bank of America doesn't do something about it.
Right. Now, but if the company has been planning all along to simply move their manufacturing elsewhere, and frankly, I'm surprised they're moving it to Iowa, not to China, if they're going to move it. But if they've decided to move their manufacturing elsewhere, you know, what if Bank of America comes along and says, okay, fine, no problem, we'll give them the money, we give, and then the managers of Republic Door and Windows say, you know, tough luck anyway. I mean, haven't they refused to meet with the workers? Might this be
No, they're actually, the union is meeting with Bank of America today at 4 o'clock.
No, I'm talking about the management of the company. Didn't the management of the company, Republic Windows and Doors, not show up at a meeting that they were scheduled for?
That's my understanding, but I really believe that Bank America does what it needs to do, that Republic Doors and Steel, Window and Doors will do what it needs to do, at least we hope so.
Okay, so the bottom line here is, if we want to stand in solidarity, or if we want to sit in with these workers in solidarity here on the Tom Hartman Program and our listeners all around the country, what can or should we do, Larry Spivak?
Well, certainly people should contact the Chicago Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, and they should contact UE Local 1110 here in Chicago. But the other thing is, if this does not get resolved today in the discussions with Bank of America on Wednesday, and I'm sorry I don't have the time, on Wednesday there's going to be a massive rally on LaSalle Street, which is kind of the, you know, second city Wall Street, if you will.
Yep.
And we will try to let Bank of America and Republic know that American workers aren't going to stand for this, that workers are going to get more and more in solidarity, just as they did at this election. The listeners should also know that President Obama came out with a statement of support of the workers today and said they did the right thing by occupying the plant, as did so many others. So workers are getting inspired, and this is kind of like taking us back in some ways to thinking about how we used to do things years and years ago.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that, you know, Obama has talked about Lincoln being one of his heroes, and Lincoln was the very first president to stop strike busting in the United States,
mm-hmm.
To officially do that and to use the word strike and to talk about workers' rights. In fact, you know, one of his famous quotes, labor is superior to capital because labor precedes capital. In other words, nobody gets rich until somebody makes something.
Right. As we say in the labor movement, labor creates all wealth.
That's right. It's true. It's absolutely true. I mean, you know, back to Adam Smith or Aristotle, I mean, it's labor creates all wealth. You're absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. My other incarnation is that I'm president of the Illinois Labor History Society, and we own the deed to the Haymarket Monument, where the real modern labor movement began here in Chicago.
Yep.
So we do think that these are the kind of issues that today's middle class is built on, and so that's why it's everybody's issue. It's not just a fight of a couple hundred workers in a factory. It's everybody's issue, as you've seen, from bailout to one thing or another. So.
We're talking with Larry Spivak. He is the regional director of Ask Me Council 31, AFSCME.org, the main website. Larry, you mentioned two places that people should contact. It's really easy for me to direct people to politicians. We have a website called callcongress.org with a bunch of toll-free numbers where people can call their members of the House of Representatives or Senate toll-free. But I don't know how to directly get people to easily contact the organizations you mentioned. Do you want to tell us how to do that? And your thoughts on contacting politicians?
Well, I mean, if it's a statement of solidarity, they can contact United Electrical Workers, Local 1110. But if the Chicago Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, which is chicagointerfaith.org, and if they Google that, they'll find it.
Okay.
They'll be able to contact somebody that way to get where we want politicians to support it. The good news is that this is one of those cases where all the politicians are coming out of the woodwork. At least the Democratic politicians in Chicago appear to be. There must have been 20 aldermen at the press conference on just a short notice. And County Commissioner Quigley and Reverend Jesse Jackson with statements of support from Jan Schakowsky, Congresswoman, was in the plant yesterday. Congressman Luis Gutierrez was in the plant on Saturday. And they've helped very much. And so this is an example of a kind of coalition that we need for workers. And it seems to be happening real fast. And let's just hope that today's talks go well.
So sitting in solidarity here on the Tom Hartman program with the folks, with the workers of Republic Doors, Windows and Doors in Chicago. We're talking with Larry Spivak, AFSCME Regional Director, Council 31. And Larry, contacting politicians, going to callcongress.org and calling your member of the House or Senate. Good idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The more that people hear, even the politicians who are friendly, who live in the district from Gutierrez's, Luis Gutierrez's.
Or all across the country. All across the country. They can bring, politicians from every state, they can bring pressure on each other.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. That's what we should be doing. It's a movement now, and we want it to continue.
Hopefully this will be the beginning of, like in the 1880s and 1890s, a new labor, new and revitalized progressive movement in the United States. Larry Spivak. Yeah, and the 1930s. There you go. Let's not forget. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, we all need to be giving a little love to the American worker. I mean, that's what it's come down to here. The middle class, the working class of this people of this country, a vanishing species. Thea Lee is on the line with us, the policy director of the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org. Hey, Thea. Thea?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
A couple of things I want to bring up. We were just a moment ago talking with Larry Spivak of AFSCME about the Republic Windows and Doors, or Doors and Windows Company in Chicago, and the worker sit-in that's happening there. People are starting to stand up, you know, unlike back, I mean, there was a feeble effort, as it were, but you go back to the 1970s when Michael Moore made Roger and Me, the story about, you know, how I believe it was General Motors, well, I know it was General Motors closed down five factories in Flint, Michigan, and moved them to Mexico, and it just devastated the city of Flint. And now people are saying, no, we're going to occupy this damn factory. At the same time, the Associated Press has this story where they were interviewing Santas, you know, people who play Santa at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And one in particular, Joe Jackson, he's been 19 years he's been playing Santa. And he says, He says, you see and hear things. He said, you see things behind the beard that nobody else will ever hear. I've had children just literally tear my heart out. Why? He says, because over and over and over they're saying, can you get my dad a job?
Oh.
I mean, this is the disaster that is happening as a consequence of the destruction of the industrial economy in the United States and a 26-year war on working people. When Reagan came into office, 25% of our workforce was unionized, and now the private workforce is down to around 7, 8, 9%. It's a disaster. We need the Employee Free Choice Act, Thea.
We certainly do, and we need to figure out how we can rebalance bargaining power in this economy, because
yes,
it's just tilted so far towards corporate greed and corporate power and the abuses that have happened that they've actually driven the economy into the toilet, because the inequality is so great. People don't have any money. They can't buy stuff. You know,
yeah,
you can't run a successful consumer-driven economy if people don't have any money. And, you know, the debt will take you only so far when you max out your credit cards and you borrow money on your house. And then at the end of the day, you need to have a paycheck, and you
yep
need to have decent benefits. And that's what we're going to have to figure out, how we can get that done. And the Employee Free Choice Act is absolutely the starting point.
Yep, the best anti-crime program, the best anti-drug abuse program, the best anti-poverty program is a good job, a good paying job. I mean, this is not rocket science. And good paying jobs, by and large, in the United States, and you know, you look all over the world historically, have to do, you know, you want good paying jobs, you want to have a union there. I mean, it's just really simple. Something needs to balance the power of management. Labor needs to balance the power of management. AFL-CIO.org, by the way, the website. We're talking with Thea Lee, the director of policy at the AFL-CIO. Union wages, 27% higher than non-union wages. 93% of union members are covered with health insurance. 76% of union members have paid sick days. On the other hand, the entire United States, wages have suffered their steepest decline in more than a decade. This is Ted Kennedy. He wrote this piece. Nearly half of all employees, 47%, don't have employee-sponsored health insurance. 42% don't even get paid sick days in the United States. What can we do to help the Employee Free Choice Act be one of the top priorities of Congress when they come back in January?
Well, we really need everybody to get in contact with their senator and their congressperson and let them know that this should be a top priority for the new Congress, because, you know, there's a lot of pressure coming from the other side. The business community is spending tens of millions of dollars to trash the Employee Free Choice Act, to try to scare people away from it and so on. So what we really need is to have our own grassroots movement where we are letting both the Obama administration and our members of Congress know in no uncertain terms just how important this is. And we want to have a lot of allies throughout the community. We want religious folks. We want, you know, our friends in the environmental and the anti-poverty communities to help us out here, because this is what we all need. If we're going to have a strong economy, if workers are going to have a voice at the workplace and a voice in the political system that's effective, we need strong unions, and we need the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah, which is how we get to strong unions. We've had 26 years of union busting, and 27 years it is now, I guess. Ever since Reagan took power in 2001, or in 19, it is amazing how time flies, isn't it? 1981. And we're talking with Thea Lee with the AFL-CIO. We have just a few seconds left. Thea, people should be contacting their members of Congress. Are there other steps that can be taken? I mean, tell your friends, lobby
tell
for
your
this.
Friends. Yeah, and, you know, write a letter to the editor, write an op-ed if you can. You know, we just want to have strong voices for working people saying, yes, we want to make it easier for workers to be able to join a union if they want to do so, and this is what we need to get our economy back on track.
Yeah, I see where TrueMajority.org, for example, is now, I just got an email from them. With a click back to, you can let your congressman know that you're in support of the workers who are you know, sitting in at Republic doors and windows. This is the kind of thing that it gets publicity. It raises the issue. It puts it on the radar screen. This is the kind of thing that I think we need to be seen more of, and hopefully we will.
Great.
Thea
Thanks,
Lee.
Tom.
Thank you very much. Thea Lee, AFLCIO.org, the website, the director of policy at the AFL-CIO. Much appreciate you being with us, Thea.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your calls next. How do we revive the middle class in America? How do we bring back to this country manufacturing? Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Baby, take off your coat. Real slow.
And time for our full Monty alert.
Baby, take off your shoes. I'll take your shoes.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can't leave your hat on.
Yeah, leave your hat on. Well, and a few other things. 130,000 inflatable boobs missing at sea. Yes, an Australian men's magazine has asked beach combers to keep a sharp eye out for inflatable breasts after 130,000 pneumatic chesticles went AWOL en route from Beijing to Sydney. You'll recall back in 1992, 30,000 Chinese plastic ducks destined for the U.S. went overboard. It took 15 years for them to end up in large part en masse on the shore of the United Kingdom. So where are the boobs going to show up? Who knows? I don't know. Does Hooters have a world headquarters near an ocean? Okay, and in New York City. If you can order, here's another one. In New York City, if you can order in chicken wings, pizza, and shop online for just about anything else, how about ordering up a pole dancer for home delivery? Yep, Alexander Ketsander, a performance artist on a mission, says he's out, and he's getting there on a bicycle rickshaw, towing an exotic dancer who gyrates on an 8-foot pole as he pedals through Manhattan. He says, I try to keep things smooth and steady, and I have to look out for potholes so no one flies off. I'm thinking of installing a helmet policy. Oh, my. Okay. Back to the serious stuff. How do we revive labor in the United States of America? You go over to economyandcrisis.org, by the way, and they point out what I've been saying here for 6 years on this radio program. You know, in the 1930s, when we had the last Republican Great Depression, we at least had a massive manufacturing infrastructure. We could build ourselves back up from the ground up. We didn't have debt. We had credit. More countries in the world owed us money than any other nation in the world. We were wealthy, even though we were experiencing a depression. As a nation, we were wealthy. And people were not, by and large, massively in debt. They might have been broke, but they weren't in debt. Things have changed. Thanks to Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., the trade policies of Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush. By the way, the governor of Illinois, Governor Blagojevich, has said, you know, yeah, we're going to stand with these guys. Here he is.
I've contacted all of our agencies across state government, and as of now, every agency has been ordered to suspend doing any business with the Bank of America. The Bank of America received $25 billion in taxpayer money as part of the financial bailout. This is exactly and precisely the kind of thing that isn't right when, on the one hand, powerful special interests get the help of taxpayer money to bail them out, the banks, and yet the purpose of that money was supposed to be to provide a line of credit to businesses like this to keep workers working and keep people employed, and yet the Bank of America has yet to step up and say that they're going to be helpful to this company and keep these workers working.
Yeah. And in the meantime, the chairman of Merrill Lynch, no relation to the Bank of America, other than that, you know, these guys all eat in the same restaurants, hang out in the same clubs, and draw the same kind of paychecks, fly in the same private jets into the same private airports, belong to the same private clubs, just like George W. Bush now moving into a private neighborhood after he leaves the White House that up until just a very few years ago had a policy that said whites only. He wants his $10 million bonus. Yes, it's going to come from your tax dollars and mine, but he wants his $10 million bonus. Damn it, it's mine, and I deserve it, the CEO of Merrill Lynch. I mean, it just doesn't get much more. This is John Thane. Doesn't get much more obscene than this. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Bernice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm surprised that President-elect Obama still has not named a labor secretary. There is so much labor unrest, so many problems in the country, and it appears that there is a diminished role for labor at the rate he's going.
Well, it's been dramatically diminished over the last 26 years. The labor secretary was a big deal from the 1930s until the 1980s, and then it became, you know, just this lowly thing.
But I think that, you know, Robert Reich did a pretty good job under the Clinton administration until they kind of said, enough of this, Robert, don't pester us anymore. I think he'd make a great labor secretary. But do you have a nominee that you'd like to propose, Bernice?
The same one,
Robert Reich. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's a great guy, and I think he'd do a fine job. Bernice, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, Flo in Sunrise, Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Flo.
Hi, Tom. I was going to talk about the governor of Illinois. Didn't he also suspend the state from doing business with Bank of America?
Yeah, that was the essence of his press conference, is that if the Bank of America thinks that they're going to get our business after they're shutting down, essentially by denying a line of credit, one of the businesses here in Illinois, they got another think coming, and good on him for doing it. Flo, thanks for the call, and right there with you. Martha in San Francisco. Hey, Martha, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm an unemployed software engineer in San Francisco. I worked for a stock brokerage firm, and back at the turn of the century, the H-1B visa program was instituted to take care of the Y2K problem.
Mm-hmm.
But they've never ever cut back on those H-1B visas.
Right. These are the visas that allow high-tech workers to come into the United States. And it used to be, and I know this because back in the 1990s, I was CEO of an ad agency in Atlanta, Georgia, Chandler McDonald, Stout Schneiderman, and Poe Inc., DBA, the Newsletter Factory. And we needed to hire somebody who was fluent in, because we were producing a newsletter for a multinational corporation, that was fluent in English, Spanish, and Japanese. And I put an ad in the paper saying I want an artist, a designer, who is fluent in these three languages. And shocked, I actually had a guy apply for the job. His name was Shinji. I don't want to say his last name on the air, but we called him Shinji Shin. And his parents were from Japan. He was born in Peru. His parents had emigrated to Peru. He lived there until he was 10, and then he moved to the United States when he was 10, and they spoke Japanese in their home. And so he spoke fluent Japanese and wrote it. He spoke fluent Spanish. He'd grown up with that, and he spoke fluent English. And I had to go through 3 months with the INS. I had to go down to meetings with him. I had to write letters. I had to run ads in the paper to prove to the Immigration and Naturalization Service that I could not find an American who could do that job. Now, that was back in 1995, I would say. And you're right. They blew that out of the water. They opened that door wide open and said anybody can come into the United States and work after, you know, to deal with the Y2K problem. And now, you know, all these big software companies are saying, hey, cheap labor. We can bring all these folks in from India and particularly countries where you can go to college for free. And you're absolutely right, Martha. And it's a door that needs to be closed, the H-1B visas. Thank you very much for that. Tanya calling from Linz, Austria. Hey, Tanya. Wie geht es Ihnen?
Oh, nicht schlecht.
Sure.
But I just wanted to comment on the laid-off workers in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah, here in Austria, situation's quite a bit different. My husband and I were actually recently working for a company here that went out of business. Company went bankrupt and had to close down.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lost our jobs. And the company owed us several months of back pay, vacation pay, severance, much like these workers in Illinois.
Right.
Fortunately, because of our crazy socialist system over here, we are getting everything that was owed to us. Basically, we've paid into, through our taxes, we pay into a fund
mm-hmm.
that then reimburses employees in this kind of situation.
So is it the?
So we're going to get.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting your severance and you're getting your vacation and you're getting your bonuses and you're getting all the things that were owed to you. Is it that the company is being forced to by both force of law and social pressure there in Austria, or is it that the government always picks up that slack when a company goes out of business?
The government always picks up the slack. Yeah, there's a fund that we pay into. So
right.
You know, but. Yeah, the government covers anything that is not able to be paid out of from the bankruptcy proceeds.
Right,
that's like it's
done in Denmark. And you know, of course, in the United States, if anybody proposed that, all the Republicans would go, "Oh my God, socialism!" So
right.
Yeah, interesting. Tanya, thank you for sharing that story.
And thank you for listening to us there in Austria, I'm assuming on the web stream, and thanks for calling in. Much appreciated. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I worked at a local GM dealership for about 16 years, and another problem that I can see with the possibility of GM going under or any of the other manufacturers is that when a car comes in for a warranty issue, say like a transmission goes out, the manufacturers tell us, okay, we're going to pay you 8 hours of wages to replace that transmission.
Right.
Now, what I can see happening is that the manufacturers are going to start cutting back on those times to save
right.
money.
Particularly if they follow Tom Brokaw's advice, declare bankruptcy and bring in Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electric, who started the whole business of outsourcing white-collar jobs to India and proudly brags of it in his book. Yeah, a good point, Steve. The ripple effects of this will be absolutely massive. Not to say that the ripple effects of NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, and everything else haven't been already. 46 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes before the hour. Hey, just a reminder to our friends listening in Portland, Oregon, Wednesday night at 7:30, I'll be at Powell's on Burnside signing the newly released paperback edition of Cracking the Code. So it's time for our Berlusconi alerts. Silvio Berlusconi, what do you do when you're a small-time crook and you got some money, so you buy a radio station, then you buy a TV station, then you buy another radio station, then you buy another TV station, then you buy a newspaper, then you buy another radio station, then you buy a radio network, then you buy a TV network, then you buy another radio network, then another TV network, and pretty soon you own 95% of all the media in Italy. What do? Well, what Berlusconi did was he ran for prime minister, which is where he is now, and now he's pushing the edge of the Italian mail. He is proposing a 25% porno tax. I tell you, he says, this is optimistic. What's more optimistic than the sight of a beautiful behind? Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Louis Palmer is with us. He is the Swiss adventurer, solartaxi.com, the website Solar Taxi. Hey, Louis, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Hey.
Welcome to the show. You are in Switzerland at the moment?
No, I'm in Portland at the moment.
You're in Portland?
Yeah, we have the World Climate Change Conference here in Poznan. And that's where I am right now. So Switzerland is still
Poland.
To go, but the world tour is finished here, you know?
I see. You're in Poland at the moment. Forgive my missing that. And you are the first person to drive a 100% solar-powered car without a single drop of petroleum all the way around the world. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's how it is. I just got here last Thursday.
And so how did it go, and where did you run out of sunlight?
So it was a spectacular ride. It took me 17 months to go all the way around the world. So from Europe down through the Middle East, India, Australia, Far East, across North America, now back to Europe again. And it was a 32,000-33,000 miles drive. And, I only lost 2 days because of breakdowns.
Wow. That's extraordinary. And was this how did you get your solar power, and how often did you have to plug in to recharge and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, things like that. About 50% of my energy came from my trailer, solar cells, which are on my trailer itself. Mm-hmm. But when I run out of sunlight, bad weather or so, I just plug it in because I have solar cells in Switzerland. That's the concept of the future. You have solar cells back home on your rooftop, and from there you feed solar energy into the grid. And then you access any power outlet along the way, and you take your energy and put it back in the battery.
Yeah,
so that gave me the other 50%.
So on a net-net basis, if you were using, say, you know, 1,000 kilowatts of electricity through the course of it by plugging in various places, and yet at the same time your solar roof back in Switzerland was feeding 1,000 kilowatts into the grid, if you think of electricity as a planetary and fungible commodity, you were 100% solar-powered, even though occasionally you had to plug in. Is that the kind of math that you're talking here?
Yeah, absolutely. You got it. That's how it is. I'm absolutely climate neutral, even though I go to the plug-in, but I'm climate neutral. Yeah.
That is great. And people can read all about this over at solartaxi.com. Do I have that right, Louis Palmer?
Yeah, that's it. Go to solartaxi.com. You can read a lot about it.
Great. Thank you very much for being with us and for, you know, letting us give you a shout there in Poland and congratulations on a great accomplishment.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Tom. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good talking with you, Louis. Kurt in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Kurt, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just heard you mentioning the HB1 visa program there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people should understand that that program is nothing more than a modern version of indentured servitude. You know, those folks come over here, of course, they're hoping to become U.S. citizens and get a green card and all that stuff. But they come over here and they're forced to work for peanuts and they can't leave the job.
Well, in a way, I mean, I know a couple of those folks and some of them are actually making two and three times what they'd make in their home country and they're sending money back home.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and I don't have a problem necessarily with that.
I have a problem with that because what it's doing is it's driving down the cost of labor here in the United States.
I don't have a problem with them coming here and working and sending money home, but I agree with you. I do have a very big problem with the way it's used to drive down our wages.
Yeah, and that's
our ability to earn a sustainable living.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. It's what we have here. Thank you, Kurt, for the call. And this is something Jack Welch of General Electric began, the arbitrage of labor, the buying and selling of labor all around the world. I was in India back in, I think it was 96, maybe 98. I traveled through India an awful lot in the 1990s. And when Microsoft was holding a big jobs fair, as I recall, it was down south. I've forgotten which city it was. But in any case, they were talking about, you know, according to the article that I read in the newspaper in India, they were hiring tens of thousands of engineers. And there's a lot of engineers in India, a lot of engineers. Michael in Burbank, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Well, I think the best way to help labor in this country is to admit, for once, its contribution to commerce, and instead of being so adversarial as to put it in its own, you know, department, have it as a part of commerce, mm-hmm. so that it has a place at the same table and is seen in a different way.
But if it was a division of the Commerce Department, it would be subordinate to it. If it was a separate cabinet position, it would be, you know, peers.
It's adversarial. It's adversarial, and it's a part of commerce. It's not.
Why not make commerce part of the Labor Department?
Huh?
Why not make commerce a part of the Labor Department? I mean, that's the way I would go with it. You know, we'll see. We'll see. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, Andre Agleton, Thieves in the Temple, America under the Federal Reserve System, and where the right went wrong on national security and the left, too. Plus, Chad Ruhle, co-author of YouWalkAway.com, about home mortgages. It's going to be an interesting day. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great one. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.